comments will come to order.
I'm sorry we're a little late getting started. We had anticipated some people being online to testify this morning, and we're waiting for them to dial in, but so far haven't. And if we hear from them later, we'll include their testimony. Senator Hoffman, Senator Stedman, Senator Co-Chair Wilkin, and myself, Senator Green are here to have several discussion topics on the health reimbursement arrangement, conversion from the defined benefits to the defined contribution plan, the ad hoc post-retirement pension adjustment, refunded accounts, and the implementation timeline. For several days now, we've had someone in the audience who wanted to testify and who signed up and has agreed each day to come back another time. Kevin Ritchie, are you ready?
Before we begin, could I?
Oh, yes, Senator Wilkin.
In our packet, I see a version F. Is that for today's consideration? Yes, for today.
Would you like to move that we can use that for our
would you like that?
Discussion? That would be good.
Sure.
Then we can refer to that in.
So that would replace G then?
We'll get a quick summary.
Yes.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt version F, Craver 33105, as a committee substitute for Senate Bill 141.
Thank you. There being no objection, we'll be working off of version F. And once this is kind of gone over further, you will find that this is incorporated the changes that my staff mentioned in her presentations about 3 days ago, and Senator Shedman had mentioned a couple of items that were typos and corrections, which are now reflected in this. And this is the version from which we will do amendments. So this is the reason we just brought this forth for discussion. Kevin, carry on.
Thank you.
Thank you for waiting. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Kevin Ritchie, and I represent the Alaska Municipal League. And I want to thank the committee and the work that's gone into this bill. The Alaska Municipal League, about a year ago, organized a group of finance directors, elected officials, other folks from school districts, the university, and municipalities. And we've been meeting for about a year, going in many of the parallel directions that you've gone in Senate Bill 141. And we've done a lot of work with municipal leaders. And I think you would agree that trying to get 800 municipal leaders, elected officials, plus business officials and finance directors and so on, educated about this issue is a huge task. And I don't think we're done yet, but we're moving along. But we've done a lot over the past year in terms of elevating this as an issue with our municipalities, and we hope with the public as well. I just want to say that as a general matter, we support the direction the committee's going in. Of course, you're not there yet, so we can't support it all. But the two things, that probably the two primary directions, the defined contribution approach is a widely accepted approach to retirement plans across the country. And one of the key policy elements that the municipal league adopted this year, last year in November, was stabilization of the future cost of the PERS and TERS program. And the defined contribution is one way of doing that, and I think it'll be more acceptable to people getting out the information you provided yesterday, comparing defined contribution, defined benefit benefits, for individuals. And I think that's a very good move. Going on to some of the more technical things, as I said, AML members do support a defined contribution approach to a new tier. We can't say that for all, but certainly that's the direction that our committee has been working in. One important point is that either the state or each individual municipality, if they don't feel like that number in the PERS program represents an acceptable level, all municipalities, school districts, university, and the state have the tools to add to that if they wish individually. On the health benefits, I think it's been testified numerous times that the key problem in the unfunded liability is the health benefits. and that 75% of the cost of the health program is accrued to the retirees before they reach the age of 65. And so the approach you're taking certainly is one that will make sense in terms of limiting access to the health benefits for people that are not actuarially paying in enough to justify the large expense of that. And we also support the concept of the health reimbursement accounts. And again, I think the comparisons that you're doing, with the current program and people's needs and so on, will probably flesh out a very good program. As far as the board goes, there's in the letter that I provided you, there's just two conceptual amendments that I think the committee will be discussing these in some form. But one thing that's not widely known is the PERS and TERS programs are not primarily a state program. They're primarily a municipal school district and university program. About 38% of the PERS and TERS system is actually the state program. 34.5% is a school program, which includes both PERS and TERS. And then cities and boroughs, about 19%, and the university, about 8.5%. So suggestion in terms of accountability, and this is one of those areas where you have to be careful what you wish for, is that municipalities, school districts, university have never been tied in structurally to the PERS and TERS system, even though they're paying the bill. That allows us the luxury now of saying, gosh, we had no way of knowing, but in the future, that's not appropriate. We would suggest that the board be structured so municipalities, school districts, and the university who own two-thirds of the system be directly represented and tied into to the board in a very direct fashion. We appreciate the positions that have been included in the draft board at this point. Our suggestion is looking at possibly adding one or two more positions and a direct way of tying the members back to the communities that they're representing, which isn't necessarily the case if it's just an appointee by the governor. One of the suggestions I think that's been discussed is having organizations representing the school districts, for example, provide three names for the positions to the governor, or some manner of having a direct structural relationship between all of the school districts and the PERS TERS board. The second recommendation, and I believe that this is going to be dealt with as an amendment, which is absolutely critical, is the changes to the PERS and TERS system, once they're made, as you know, can never be taken away from the individuals who those benefits have been promised to, even if it's 25 years in the future. The way changes to the PERS and TERS system have been made in the past have always fallen under the regular fiscal note process of having 5 days to come up with some sort of a fiscal note. And it just isn't possible to analyze the impacts of changes to people as far as or all the employers as far as 25 or 30 years into the future in that period of time. Creating a structural system to analyze each future change to the PERS and TERS systems in terms of an actuarial analysis, and then providing that actuarial analysis to all of the employers so they know what's coming and they can make comments, and then providing a recommendation to the legislature on that change would possibly have kept the state away from some of the liability that it now faces. The municipalities, unlike the teacher retirement system, which is one big system, the PERS program is a totally separate liability and a totally separate program for each one of the municipalities and the school districts that are participating in the program. So, for example, whereas the TRS system, there's one rate, there's a separate rate for every municipality and a separate unfunded liability for each municipality.
Is there any blending of that rate between or among municipalities, or is it set rate per entity?
Madam Chairman, the way they do it is there's a blended rate, which I guess you might call the normal rate, and then if that normal rate is insufficient, then they have a past unfunded liability, and then a separate unfunded liability rate added to the normal rate for each community. So what can happen, a good example was last year, there was analysis done of the financial impact of changing benefits for public safety people. And when that analysis was done, there was an analysis done by the actuaries, but the assumptions that went into that hadn't really been tested with the employers. And so the impact that the actuaries thought was going to happen was disputed by a number of the municipalities because they had different experience than the actuaries were assuming. And so that process of taking some time to not only do an actuarial analysis, but also to provide that to the different members for comment, and then bringing it back to the PERS-TERS board and then to the legislature, really makes a tremendous amount of sense in terms of trying to figure out the impact of changes to the system in the future. Madam Chairman, then just to finish up, I just wanted to re-emphasize the really critical nature of, and this was probably beyond the scope of the bill, but tied into the bill, the absolutely critical scope of providing at least 2 years of assistance from the state to the municipalities and school districts, of course, and the university for offsetting the 5% increase in the PERS system that's going to take place no matter what happens at this table. The recommendation is really serious because when you say a 5% increase in PERS rates, that sounds like, well, maybe that's not that big a thing, but most municipalities, about 75% of their budget is salary. In boroughs, it's not including the local contribution to schools, which is a huge part of their budget, but about 75%. So if you take 75% of a 5% increase, it comes out with about a 3.75% increase in the operating budget for a municipality on the average each year. In addition, of course, you've got fuel costs, which are skyrocketing, and that affects everything, goods, transportation, everything else. Insurance costs are skyrocketing. So at this particular time, this is really a critical piece to allow municipalities. We can't raise property taxes enough. And I think many citizens think they're pretty high right now. So this would be a very critical help. But anyway, with that, I just want to tell you, thank you all for the work you've been doing. We are employers exactly like the state, and we'll continue working with you through this each step of the way. So thank you.
Senator Seven, did you have any response, or do you want to hold off to
that? No, let me just pipe in just a little bit. There's on the board, and I understand what Mr. Ritchie's comments are as far as the allocation of you know the state's portion versus the schools versus the cities and boroughs and versus the university and why the board was structured the way it was, and clearly it's open for amendments. But why we structured it initially the way we did was we wanted representation from PERS and TERS, but ultimately the deep pockets of the state of Alaska. And when everything goes into turmoil, all the parties, including the university and the cities, have a tendency of coming to the state for help. And that's why the board was set the way it is. And sometime we certainly could have a discussion if we should add or modify that membership. But
and to the size of the committee gets unwieldy. You know, as numbers go up, and we're trying to keep it the most direct and kind of framing it somewhat similar to the permanent fund board as far as expertise and interest and then objectivity as well, because there's something there's great potential for conflict on both sides. And certainly for the one who's going to be the beneficiary, there has a concern as well as the payer. So anyway, thanks, Kevin. Sorry, Senator Stedman.
I have one follow-up, and then on the issue of having more involvement in with the actuary and a little slower process on statutory changes, and to make sure that the legislature has a, you know, a really good handle on liabilities. We've talked about that, and I think we're trying to get that language in the bill, but apparently, I don't think it's in version F yet. We'll have other versions. Just speaking for myself, I'd like to see language like that in there, because sometimes it's, and last year was a good example where the fiscal statement moved all over the table from, I think, about $8 million to $80 million, if I remember correctly. But we are taking note of that, and if there's, you know, agreement at the table, then I guess we'll have that in there. I just passed a note back to check if it got in version F, but apparently it's not in there yet.
Okay, thanks. Senator Hogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin, thanks for your testimony and thanks for your hard work. We know you've been active and that hasn't gone unnoticed. And thank you. In regard to the 90-day issue on powers and duties of the board, Section 42, would you be married to 90 or would you consider a time less? And the reason I ask that is that if on day one of a session there needed to be a change, you would essentially put that effort on hold for 90 days, so you'd have 30 days left in a session to put something through. You think we could pull that back to perhaps 60? I like the suggestion very much, because I think your conclusion at the top paragraph is exactly right. But would you consider that perhaps we could do it in 60 days? That would give us at least a half a session to get a bill through.
Through the Chair, yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And then the other thing I want to tell you about the election process that currently goes on with the elected presbyters members is, you know, for the 2 years, it's about $100,000. And that comes out of that fund. I think that's excessive. And we think there's probably far better ways for there to be something other than an election. And we want to go with that. And certainly, and I will say that the legislature has observed with some displeasure some of those appointments to the governor that come with only X number of appointees. And I would certainly want it to be a very broad, if we were to do that, I would, and it would be optional as far as I'm concerned. Suggestions, yes. Well, we all have the opportunity to suggest members for boards, but that'll be probably topic for some future conversations as well.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, thank you for that. And we were not suggesting that there be an election. I think
that would not make
fiscal sense for employers. The advantage of having some, and maybe we don't have the right method exactly, but the structural connection in the management is, though Senator Stedman is certainly correct, that ultimately the state is a deep pocket. The liability that actually is accrued to municipalities, I think, is viewed pretty much like a bond debt. So we're kind of all the deep pocket, too.
Senator Wilkin, did you have
I figured it out. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. And in Fairbanks, we have Leslie Teeters. Would you begin your testimony, please? Announce who you're with. Is Fairbanks online? Leslie?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Would you go ahead and begin your testimony, please? Give your name and who you're with.
My name is Leslie Teeters. I work for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm also the president of Alaska Higher Education Crafts and Trades Employees. We do the maintenance on the campuses all over the state. Although this Senate bill doesn't directly affect our employees, but it does in a sense, though, too, because we are, of course, taxpayers in the community. We're concerned about, I'm concerned that this bill punishes employees who've not created this problem and places employees' retirement into private accounts that will make retirement uncertain for most employees. I've looked into some information about 401k plans as an example, and it's shown that employees are terribly unprepared and are unknowledgeable about investments. They normally pick investments that give them the least risk, which means normally at the lowest return. This creates a problem that continues on throughout the years, and I'm afraid that what will happen is in the future we'll have a huge number of people that will be woefully unprepared for retirement without the funding to be able to help them. I know that there, I appreciate that we've looked at this problem that looks to be that with PERS and TERS, that there needs to be something done, but I don't think that a change over from a defined benefit to a defined contribution is the way to go. I think there may be some combinations of other things that we can look at, and I would suggest, or I would greatly appreciate if you would consider looking at other options here for the future and not attacking the employees that work under the system that serve this state as it is now. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Is there anyone else in Fairbanks that is wants to testify?
No, not at this time.
Thank you. That looks like it's all we have on teleconference that has called in. So, Tracy, are you ready to begin your presentation? This is the health reimbursement arrangement. We want to get that packet out. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tracy Carpenter. I'm staff to Senator Green. This morning, we're going to go over the health reimbursement arrangement. And Rose, could you distribute the new page 11? I caught an error on myself, so I wanted to get it corrected for
Thank
the
you.
Members of the committee, but it's the very last page. So. Just to go over what exactly is a health reimbursement arrangement. This is a plan that reimburses employees for qualified medical expenses during their retirement years. It's intended as a supplement for medical expenses or a bridge under this plan between an early retirement age of 55 perhaps, and then until you reach Medicare eligible age, it's possible to do that. It is an employer paid group fund. That means only the employer pays into it, and the funds are pooled as opposed to being in individual accounts. Funds accumulate over the working lifetime of the employee. They are both tax-free to both the employer and the employee. And the HRA is, the benefit to the state is that it's a very flexible plan. The state can design it pretty much any way they want to. Turning to page 3, the specific plan design we have in SB 141, the employer contributes 1% of the average employer group compensation up to a maximum of $500.
That's per year?
Per year, yes. It is an annual payment on behalf of each active employee into the fund. The contributions are recorded two ways. One, into an individual account. It's not that the money is there, it's a paper recording for each employee, and also an account balance for the employer so that you know their balances can be tracked as well. The fund is managed by the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and they determine the annual amount of interest and credit to each employee's individual account within the plan. Total reimbursements are only limited to the member's individual account balance. So reimbursements are not limited until the balance is gone. Terminated employees forfeit the rights to the individual account. If that person were to come back to work within 5 years, then the account balance of the employee at the time they terminated would be restored to that employee in their name. Which brings me to a talking point. The present language states that the person actually has to return to work with the same employer that they left. But if they come back into the system and they work for a different employer who is also participating in the retirement system, they still, their years of service with the other employer still count and they accrue based on that. So I just thought maybe it would be a discussion of the committee or for the committee about whether we should make some provisions for for if an employee returns within 5 years to a participating employer, regardless of whether they were with that employer before.
Would that be an example of someone who works for a municipality and then comes into state employment or state employment to a teacher's employment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Well, so. I don't know about, well, yes, I believe there are provisions for the...
Okay. If
actually, I couldn't address the difference in the between the procedures at the moment.
If the public entity has the health reimbursement account, it would be transferable if you come back to employment within 5 years.
Well, that's another, that's, Madam Chair, that's kind of an issue because it is our intent, it's the intention that surplus funds held in the trust that are credited to the employer can be used to make future payments that they owe.
Right.
And so it's kind of a complicated, if you transfer that to another employer, what are you really doing? So,
okay, since it's employer specific to make the contribution, okay. So you want to think of that or mull it over. Thank you.
Just to throw something into the works there.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Wilk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tracy, what's the definition of terminated? If I'm terminated for absenteeism?
Well, I suppose, through the Chair, Senator Wilkin, that would be a negative termination, but just if you quit for whatever reason, whether you intend to retire, if you want to go take another job, if you're moving from the state, it's just leaving employment with your employer.
So it could be voluntary termination or involuntary.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tracy. Go ahead.
And just the last bullet that's highlighted, as I said, it has been our intention to allow employers to use surplus funds to credit other employees' accounts going forward if they have it, sort of along the lines of the conversation we had the other day when Senator Hoffman inquired what happens to excess money within the trust when we were talking about the medical plan. So who is eligible for reimbursements? We're on page 5. Any member of the plan who meets the age or service requirements for medical benefits, as we discussed the other day. And just to refresh, that is 25 years of service for peace officers and firefighters or 30 years service for all other classifications, or you've reached the age of 65 and you have a minimum of 10 years of service. Also, the surviving spouse of an eligible member is eligible. And dependent children of an eligible member if they are, if both the member and the spouse have died. Just as a note on the current work draft version F, that has been dropped out. And I believe that was just an inadvertent happening in the communications with the drafter. So it's my intention to bring forth a technical amendment to fix that tomorrow.
So on that. The point, going back to the other page, it says that if they, on page 4, if an individual leaves work and he has 10 years already, then those dollars do not go into the trust and the employer can't use those for future payments. That, those dollars are fixed in his account once he works 10 years because when he's 65, he can access those.
But the Chair, Senator Hoffman, that would be correct since we have removed the requirement to retire from active service, but the way the bill is written, it would not be correct. And so I thank you for pointing that out. That's another correction that should probably be made to that section. Page 6, the benefits payable include, basically the qualified medical expenses under 26 U.S.C. 213D, which also would include monthly premiums for a major medical plan. And I've written down here that I don't believe that participation in the state's retiree medical plan is required, but now that I think about it, I think that might be an error, and I might just ask... the Director of Retirement Benefits that question. Maybe her understanding would be.
Melanie? Can you give us some assistance here? Or do you want to just think about it and come back to it? You want to think about it? Sure. Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead, Tracy.
The expenses that would be reimbursed, the medical expenses, are those of the eligible member, the member's spouse, and their dependent children. And the surviving spouse and the member's dependent children if they're dependent on the surviving spouse. So those are all the qualified medical expenses that would be covered for.
Tracy, would you, just for those of us who may not know or have ever been around a reimbursement account, what's an example of what happens if you are a member with a health reimbursement account? What is the procedure? You have a monthly medical expense that's not covered in your standard plan or is over the counter?
Madam Chair, are you familiar with the Active Employees Health, reimbursement? The HECRA, the Active Employees, it's called HECRA, and I'm trying to think of how that goes. It's the health. It's employees' health reimbursement account, basically,
okay,
that
okay.
We have. It's a flexible savings account, and when the active employees incur medical expenses, they can get reimbursed from that account during the year. And
so this
there's
might
an
be
automatic
for a copay. Could be for a copay or.
Yes, Madam Chair. Copay.
Okay.
Yes, copays. The deductible, if you know. You have to meet a deductible of $500 a year. If you've put that much into your HECRA, you can be reimbursed for that. And there's a process. You either apply, fill out a form, and send it in to the administrator, the third-party administrator, or you elect a streamlined option, which generally means that it just sort of happens automatically. The doctor mm-hmm. files the paperwork, and it comes back.
Okay.
This would be the same arrangement, I would imagine, that you either apply for it.
But the employee or the retired person would have to actively do something in order to trigger a reimbursement.
Madam Chair, that's correct, unless the department makes some other arrangements. Okay. I would have to defer to them to handle that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Beginning on page 7, similar to what Senator Stedman and Miles Baker did for the DC contribution accounts, I crunched some of those numbers that I didn't have the other day and came forward with what the account balances of the HRA might look like, at 10, 15, 20, 25, and 30-year intervals. And I've done that for what the cap, the 1% and the cap under SB 141. And you can see there the assumptions here are the beginning salary in FY 2006 is $35,000. The salary inflation rates are the same that Mercer uses in their tables, 5.5% for the first 5 years and 4% thereafter, and then the projected anchored CPI going forward, which we actually received from Dr. Soley the other day, so that was very helpful. And I've also used an 8.25% interest rate and a 6% interest rate so that we can see the differences. And then what I did, if you go to page 8, I started with a 30-year account balance under SB 141 and tried to project how quickly those funds would be spent down. If this person reaches the age of 65 and has 30 years of service, their contribution rate towards the monthly premium, the Medicare premium, because they would be eligible for Medicare, is 10%. So I have the column that represents the annual 10% contribution towards health care, annual deductibles of $500, interest credited to the account. That rate, I believe, is 4%, a modest amount relative to the need to have the funds be fairly liquid. And then just balances going forward. Clearly, this does not take into account real expenses that may be incurred during the year. I just wanted to get some numbers out on the table so that members could just have an idea of what might happen to the account.
I also want to welcome Senator Bundy and Senator Olson. Senator Shev, you have a question?
Yes, could we maybe slow down a little bit and back up to page 7?
Okay.
Because I think this is a, you know, when we worked on our draft and came out and we put down the concept initially of 1% of salary by the employer with a $500 cap. And I think yesterday we were talking about we might have about 2% to work with as far as being able to move around, and it's 2%. One, there's two likely areas we can put it. One of them is into the retirement and moving that up from 11 and a quarter up a couple of percent, or put it in here. So if I'm reading your table correct, if we just use a 6% table, the bottom one on page 7, currently we're at 1% with a $500 cap. So if we took half of that amount we have to work with, we could initially then go to the 2% and then remove the cap. And then under this scenario, after 20 years, it would be $39,000 in there. Am I reading that correct? And then
through the chair, yes, sir.
And if it happened to be, you know, if you started very young and you worked 25 years, you can go to 62 and then 30 at 96. And then, is this money taxable when it comes out of there?
The chair, no. Senator Stedman is not.
So then this money then, when they pull that out, would be tax-free? And when they pull money out of the retirement account, that money then would be taxed at the normal rate.
That's correct.
So one of the things we should consider possibly when we look at amendments is if we take this 2% that we have to work with, it may be more beneficial to the employee to put, you know, 1% of it over here because they could pull it out tax-free. And maybe look at, you know, is that an option, 1% in the defined contribution side or all of it? But there is a significant tax difference and tax savings to the employee. And I just wanted to, you know, to point that out. And in the event that they happen to do above 6% and maybe they go to 8 or 8 1/4, there could be a substantial tax-free account available to work with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologize for being late. I was about my father's business or at the governor's prayer breakfast, however you might want to view it. For Tracy, these are funds that would be used between retirement and age 65, is that correct?
Chair, Senator Bundy, they may be used during that age if the person reach their service requirements.
Yeah. And as we were doing exploratory calculations, I think it was mentioned that if someone retires before 65 to get health insurance, it would cost about $800 a month. But I think those are in current dollars. Now, I guess we don't know what it would cost in the future, but I, of course, know health insurance 10 years ago was a lot cheaper than it is today, and I think we need to try to speculate what it would be if this plan went into effect, and in 10 years from now, someone had to pay that health insurance. I know I'm asking you to look at your crystal ball, but have you put that into calculations as to what might be available for a person to pay that premium between some retirement earlier than 65 and age 65?
Through the Chair, Senator Bundy, yes, I have. That's the very last slide.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead.
That's okay, Ed, but that brings me to a good point. I should explain that the annual health premium that I'm showing is actually, I took today's premium and inflated it based on Mercer's projected trend up until the point where it reached 5%, which brought it to just over $20,000. And I chose that point to begin because what I hear is that at some point, something has to cap the medical increases, otherwise it'll just take up your entire income. I just chose that point of $20,000, and then from there, every year thereafter, I indexed it by 5% per year going forward. So I did take a stab at it.
Okay, thank you.
And then if that's the case, if this is for when you retire, where are the premiums while you're employed for your health care?
For the chair, Senator Hoffman, those are paid by the state through the employer, and generally the employee shares the cost. Active employees do.
And that would be, that plan would be similar to what's being covered today in benefits?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Whatever's the coverage that we're receiving today as employees, that same health coverage would apply to people under the defined contribution plan for
the chair, Senator Hoffman, I believe that is true, but I would ask for it. The director is shaking her head, yes.
Why don't you come on up, Nellie, so if you need to answer a question, you can. Please, thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, for the record, my name is Melanie Melhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and yes, it is contemplated that members under the DC plan would have an active medical plan, not which would be very similar to what the current active employees have right now. There wouldn't be any differentiation. Same plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I guess I do have a question.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Do we have an idea of what the medical costs are average for employees after they retire, so we can get an idea of what those expenses are versus what dollar volume we're seeing here, so we can make the decisions that Senator Stedman is possibly proposing, the 1% versus the 2%, so that, you know, that how close are we to reaching that goal? I'm sure that we're not, we're probably underfunded, because most of the health care costs come late in life and not early.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, if I understand your question, I believe that the FY 2004 health cost experience for pre-Medicare eligible retirees was approximately $5,400. That information I have is contained in Mercer's November 19th presentation. I just don't have it to hand. But I believe it's in the neighborhood of $5,400 is the FY04 experience, claims experience.
Per person.
Per person.
That's
an average.
Right.
Average. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Ready, Tracy?
Then we could go back to page number 6.
Okay.
We had the question, I actually questioned myself about whether
participation,
the monthly premiums could be, if the retiree could go out and procure their own health insurance, was my thought here. And then I doubted myself, but I believe Melanie says that's accurate.
This is correct. Would not be required that the member participate in the state's retirement plan and still be able to use their health reimbursement arrangement dollars. It's not a requirement.
Thank you. Okay, so if they were 55 and retired and had a separate insurance policy, went out and bought a separate policy, they could still use the HRA as their backup for additional cost or unpaid cost.
Correct, so long as they satisfied the service requirements of the 25 years or the 30 years.
They're fully eligible retiree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Senator Bundy, raise your hand.
No, thank you.
Madam Chair, they could also pay that premium. from the HRA. If I went out and purchased from Golden Rule a health plan, I could pay that premium from the HRA. And that's what I was trying to get across with this, and then...
Oh, does that help, Senator Hoffman? Yeah, I think, yeah, I'm not sure I was clear on that, so that's a very good point. Good, 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 good. Thank you. Thank you.
I believe we were on slide 8. The remaining slides are just further examples of taking the numbers from slide number 7, plugging them into the beginning balances and applying a scenario. Slide number 9, just to give a different idea, is an age 65 retiree with 20 years of service. So they're Medicare eligible, and their required contribution rate would be 20%. Because they've only been working for 20 years, their account hasn't built up quite as much, even though this is a 2% contribution rate here without cap. And so you can see that if the person's perfectly healthy and they don't ever have any medical expenses, then this account would last till they're approximately 75 years old.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Slide,
any questions?
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Slide number 10. The same scenario as slide number 8, only the contribution here was 1.5% with no cap, so you get quite a different balance. And I did attempt to add a few more expenses in there just to see what would happen, so I used $3,000. Perhaps I should have used the $5,400 figure that we just discussed earlier to give a more accurate idea. And then on slide number 11, which I think there's a separate page because I caught myself, or actually my coworker caught me in the error. When that person reaches the age of 65, they are Medicare eligible, and so they have 30 years of service in. This 55-year-old has 30 years of service, so when they hit 65, then they cost share with the employer, and their contribution drops to 10%. Under this scenario here, they've been paying the full premium all along for these 10 years. Then when they hit 65, it drops dramatically to $3,281 per month, and so the account could conceivably last longer.
Oh, yeah.
Or another thing that this demonstrates is the bridge between the age of 55 or early retirement to Medicare. And what I was looking for here was I wondered what was the, how much did we actually have to contribute into the HRA to get to a dollar amount that might actually work? And so that's how I got to the 3.5%.
Senator Hoffman.
Was there any discussion or consideration of the employee having the option to participate if we have the 1% and a $500 cap? And if so, is that, would those dollars be taxable?
The Chair, Senator Hoffman, are you, you're asking if the employee will be able to elect it, or
option to participate at some level?
The way the bill is written, no. And the reason is that this is an employer-paid fund. Employees are not allowed to contribute to the fund.
Right. I know it. But we have all these. We haven't decided on what level of funding currently. And Senator Stedman is proposing that we consider the other 1% to make it 2% and possibly even higher. And I'm wondering if an employee thinks that he wants coverage in the future, could we consider that as an option? And if so, the employee contributing, would that be taxable?
The Chair, Senator Hoffman, the employee cannot contribute to this account.
Under the current system.
Under the current system. And I do not believe it's allowable under federal regulations.
It is not allowable.
That is correct. That's our information from Mercer, is that it's not allowable, this particular type of arrangement.
So otherwise it would lose its tax
status.
Exempt. With the tax exempts. status at risk probably as well.
Through the chair, Madam Chair, I don't know that it would lose its status. I think then it might be more considered a health savings account, which is more similar to a 401K, and that it becomes owned by the employee.
Right, right.
And they can use it right now.
And a distinguishing characteristic of this is this is an employer contribution only.
And only to be used during retirement years. During the active working lifetime of the employee, they cannot access these funds.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Do you have anything else on that, Tracy?
I think so.
You want to? Okay, Senator.
When it's appropriate, I had asked at our last meeting that Tracy have an opportunity to discuss this sheet that indicated how Alaska compares with retirement plans in other states. And I don't know if you'd like to do that now or...
You want to do that now or later?
Madam Chair,
okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, and Madam Chair.
Yes.
I know we're famous for not giving a hoot how they do it outside, but I think it might be instructive to get an idea how Alaska compares and how rigid our requirements are for retirement compared to other states. And Tracy, as I read this, there's a lot of other states that have a rule of 80, 85, or 90, and that is age plus working years have to total 80, 85, or 90, depending on the state, in order to qualify for retirement. Am I correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Bundy, that is correct.
Yeah. And also looking at the chart you prepared for us, and thank you for that, looks like there's probably 38 states that have a more rigid retirement requirement than Alaska does. Is that?
Through the Chair, Senator Bundy, the first 25 states on this list all require, their normal retirement age is 65 and with varying numbers of years. And then there are a few other states that have higher ages for number of retirement years than Alaska does at the present.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking at Alaska's the blue line, and to retire, you can retire at age 60 if you have 8 years of service. And there are a couple others that are, I think I see one other that's less than that, but others you have to be 65 and have 10 years of service, or 62 and, but a lot of them with 65 and 10 years of service, or you can retire at any age with 20 years of service if you're enlisted for teachers. And again, that's a little more flexible, because the others have any age of 25 or 30 years of age. And the reason I bring it up is I hear not too infrequently that if the retirement changes, we're not going to be able to recruit talented teachers. And I would say that there are a number of other states, if that were true, that would have a far greater recruiting difficulty than Alaska would, because they not only have tougher retirement, they don't have our mountains. And again, we don't have to do what other people do, but it appears that the current retirement system is less rigid than the requirements are less rigid than a number of other states, and if we made the change we're looking at, I don't know that we'd be any more demanding in any of these other states. In your review, would that be a valid statement?
Chair, Senator Bundy, I believe so. The national trend seems to be moving towards the age of 65 as a normal retirement age. The lines that are highlighted in yellow are some of our nearest neighbors, so you can see that they're They're all popped up there at the 65-year.
Thank you. And then, spirit of full disclosure, I've been retired 13 years, and I'm 66, so I have benefited from our current system and don't want to indicate to anyone that I'm not aware of that.
Thank you. Senator Wilken.
Madam Chair, Tracy, did you put this table together?
Through the chair, Senator Wilken.
Very well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask, let's just look at Arizona. If Arizona's yellow and it's a blank in the four cells that are under teachers, so does that mean that they don't have a teacher retirement system or the teachers fall under other?
The chair, Senator Wilken, the teachers fall under other.
So all the states have a teacher retirement system in one manner or the other?
80.
Through the chair, Senator Wilken, I believe that's a fairly accurate statement.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from this handout? Thank you, Judge. That is well done. Thank you very much. And we'll go now to the conversion from the defined benefits to the defined contribution plans, which you'll find in another packet. I also wanted to welcome Commissioner Matuszewski here with us today. He's joined us for the discussion. We're glad to have you. Thank you for your help.
Fortunately, this presentation is very short.
Good.
Okay. We do not yet have language in the bill to allow an employee conversion, but it has been the intention all along to do that. And the idea for eligibility is twofold. In the first part, an employer must actually choose to allow their employees to convert from the defined benefits plan to the DC plan, because there's going to be a significant cost associated with that, in that they're going to have to come up with new funding in order to do that. It is probably not a good idea to transfer employer contributions in the existing defined benefits trust from that fund into another fund, because that money could be deemed as being used for other beneficiaries who are not beneficiaries of the current trust.
Is this what's covered in the Deloitte?
Madam Chair, yes. In part, it is.
In part. You might want to review this Deloitte letter that answers five questions from Anthem Stack, and it sort of crossover to this discussion. Yes, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tracy, of course, we're well aware that constitutionally we cannot change the retirement system of current vested members.
Sir? You can change it, but you can't reduce it.
Well, you can't reduce it. Excuse me. Thank you for the correction. But is there any law that would require us to make the new plan available to the current members?
Future. No, Senator Bundy.
And then a question for Senator Stedman. Were we to do this and make the new plan available to the current members, which in my mind, the resistance I hear for the new system, I don't think there'd be a huge rush to do that, but there might be. Wouldn't that, if we took current members and moved them into defined contribution, what impact would that have on the current deficit?
I don't think it would have any effect at all on the unfunded liability, would be my expectation, because it's already an accrued liability. But you know, we may have to go back and check on that, because there may be some strings attached to that last statement I made may not be actually correct. I think the concept of when we're working on this, as far as allowing some employees the option to convert, is that I think depending on age and length of service, and we expect this plan to be competitive against the current benefit structure for the Tier 2 TERS or the Tier 3 PERS, and it may be beneficial under certain ages to be in the new plan versus the old, and they may want to convert over. So we're just, you know, conceptually, that's why we put it in there. I don't think it would, certainly would not be advantageous for Tier 1, and most likely Tier 2. And it would probably only be beneficial to the Tier 3 employees that are younger and haven't been in the system a long time.
Yeah, if I might just continue this for a moment. Intuitively, and again, I bow to your expertise in this area, but if we've got a deficit and we of our current group of people, and we take some people out of that group, it seems as if then the deficit might increase because we have fewer people contributing.
Reduced your liability.
I'm sorry?
You've reduced your liability.
Well, and I'm trying to decide if that balances out.
Let me answer. I guess there's two ways we can look at it, and I think the more appropriate way is not in ratios, but in actual dollars or cash flow. And as we want to go back and check on the conversion, because just off the top of my head, I want to check on the conversion. If an individual wants to convert and he has to that individual some portion of an unfunded liability, to find out from someone on the effect of that liability. As far as, you know, if it's going to, you know, if he converts, what kind of rights and so on and so forth. So let us get back to you on that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I didn't need to look for an answer out to the third decimal. It was just conceptual question, and if you would keep it in mind as you go through the process, I'd appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, that sort of brings us to bullet point number two, which is that the intention here is only to offer a conversion option to employees who are not vested in the current systems.
Who are not vested. Okay, thank you.
So those would only be PERS members with less than 10 years of service and TERS members with less than 8 years of service. If a member elects to transfer into the DC plan, that participation is irrevocable, and it is in lieu of the defined benefits plan, and the employee will be advised that they will give up all of their rights that they may have earned under that system. On page four, just the mechanics of the conversion, the idea is that an employer who allows their employees to convert would have the present value of the member's contribution account balance that's held in trust in their name deposited into a new account, and there would be a 100% match of that account balance by the employer. And again, it would have to be new money, and that's the reason for the option that the employer gets the first option to choose this. The other idea is that any years of service credit that employee has under the existing system would also be credited to the new system for purposes of vesting or earning the medical benefits. So that if you have 4 years and you move over to the new system, you've got 4 years towards your 10-year requirement. Slide number five, we asked the Division of Retirement and Benefits to...
I have a question on that.
Oh, go ahead.
And is there a window, or can employee wait until and look at the options of what benefits are like at retirement age and make that decision?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, we have not put a time, or we will not put a time limit on the conversion. However, people will naturally, when they become vested in the PERS and TERS system, lose their eligibility to choose. So they only have that window of time to
before they're invested.
Before they become vested in the PERS, in the existing tiers.
Thank you.
On... Madam Chair, if you would indulge me, I'd like to go back to slide number three, and I meant to bring this up. It's kind of a tricky situation with PERS Tier 3. It only takes 5 years to vest in the system, but they have to have 10 years before they're eligible for system-paid medical coverage. And so there still may be some incentive for that employee to convert. I don't know.
At age eight, at year eight, or?
Yes, if they're a PERS employee and they're vested for their benefits, but they're not vested for their medical, there may be no incentive at all.
Right.
And so, you know, perhaps we don't want to do this, but that was our original thought, and which brings me back to page number five, which shows we tried to get what the potential cost to employers would be if we're going to require them to match 100% of members transferring their individual account balances to a new plan, and they have to match 100%, what would that cost? Well, you can see that on this slide, the total dollar amount of in the members' individual accounts is over $2 billion. So that just didn't seem like that was going to happen.
But that is if everyone eligible.
That would be if everyone eligible. So we've limited it to only unvested members. Mm-hmm. And I guess technically I haven't limited unvested members, but the idea was for Tier 3 members with less than 10 years of service and Tier 2 TERS members with less than 8 years of service.
Well, it would just be the $102 million plus the $280 million?
That totals at the bottom to $290 million for those groups. So that would be the maximum, theoretically, of what the employers would have to match if all of those people
People eligible who are not vested transferred. Okay. Yes, Senator.
Okay. Madam Chair. Tracy, could we look at page four? And would you just help me with an example? Right? Present value of the member contribution account balance held in the defined benefit trust will be transferred to a new account. So if I had $10,000 then in my DB trust, then explain to me, how does paragraph two work?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, if a member has $10,000 in their individual account that they have paid, that's their 6.75% plus their interest, the account will be transferred and the employer pays the same dollar amount. They put $10,000 in there, so you now have a $20,000 defined contribution account.
Okay, and then what does it mean? This must be new money.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, that means that we don't think it's a good idea to allow employers to transfer money from the trust, and the existing DB trust, meaning they can't take the $10,000 out of that trust and put it into the new plan.
Okay, I understand. Okay, thank you.
Which would address my concern about increasing the deficit.
That's true.
The final slide, page number six, is an example of what a current PERS Tier 3 member might receive in their lifetime of benefits after they retire. If they work for 30 years, they retire at the age of 60. Assume this is a male with a life expectancy, and I have that wrong. I beg your pardon, that life expectancy would be different at age 60. But what I've done here, I took a beginning salary of $35,000. We inflated it into the future. The member contributes 6.75% of that pay per year, semi-annually. Interest is credited. The rate currently is 4.25%. I don't know how long that rate has actually been paid in there. And down at the bottom, what I've tried to demonstrate is how much money this member has contributed over that 30-year period into their retirement plan. And the amount appears to be in the neighborhood of $209,000. That person has worked for 30 years, and under the current statutes, their benefit formula, total 67.5% of what their highest five consecutive years of average salary has been during their lifetime, which in this scenario is the last 5 years of their employment. I just use that number. If this person had just worked in the same job for 30 years, obviously at the end of their period, they're going to, those will be their highest 5 years. So 67.5% of that amount, of the 68,750, excuse me, the average turned out to be 68,750. So 67.5% of that is $46,400. I multiplied that by the 23.8 years, which is slightly inaccurate. And then I did the medical premium similar to what I did for the HRA, inflated it up to the $20,000 per year and started from that point going forward with 5%. And then did the annual premium over the 23.8 year period, which totals $1.8 million in payments for medical and pension benefits over the expected lifetime of this employee. The numbers are not quite accurate because I picked the wrong life expectancy. Mm-hmm. But I believe the example is
yeah.
Well, actually, the numbers would probably be a little bit lower because the life expectancy would be shorter. Starting at the age of 60, I believe the life expectancy related to the 23.8 years is a 55-year-old male.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I just did a quick modification on the life expectancy and here, you know, it's at 83. I lower it down to 78, this is a guess conversation, drops that 1.823 number on the bottom down to about 1.4.
Okay.
Yeah, 1.338. So just as a ballpark, we can, for conversation, bump it down, and it's close.
I'll update this and distribute the correct sure. numbers to the table. What I was trying to demonstrate was the percentage that the employee contributes to their retirement versus mm-hmm. what the employer contributes. And that's to only if, you know, there's potential for more payments by the employer if the person lives longer than expected.
Thank you. And now this is we're talking about conversion, but this is a current defined benefit plan for a Tier 3.
Chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct.
Yeah, so their retirement salary, annual salary is $46,004.
That's correct.
And thank you. And then the percentages you have to the right of those columns, can you tell me again what that is?
Chair, Senator Bundy, that is the employee's percentage, 11.48%. It represents $209,000, which is 11.48% of the total $1.8 million that I have here being paid out.
And the 88% is that they didn't use 100%. They used 88%.
The $1.8 million through the chair is the total, is the 100%. That is the total amount of benefits being paid to that employee. After you subtract the member's contribution, because under the statutes, the member's contribution gets paid out first, then the employer's contribution was 88%.
Any other questions?
I forgot to sign my name. I just put a check.
Okay, good. Very good. Okay, thank you.
Does that conclude?
That concludes my presentation, Madam Chair.
Senator Shedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the next issue we're going to take a look at, our next topic of discussion, is containing the liabilities in our current system. And with that, I'd like to ask one of my staff, Miles Baker, to come on up and lead the charge.
What is your topic?
I think it's containing liabilities in our current system.
I have written down here the ad hoc.
Ad hoc. Okay, we'll do that.
Okay.
It's all wrapped together in that one.
Okay, very good.
That was the presentation.
This is the correct one, Miles? The packet?
Yes.
The.
What does it look like? Our famous map.
Yeah, the containing liabilities in our system has the Alaska map on it.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't do that later. Next one down.
Morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Miles Baker, staff to Senator Bert Stebbins.
And what I wanted to do today is just walk you through a couple of the three items that, one of which is already in the bill, the other two have, we're proposing be considered to be put in the bill, and were things that we've always discussed, but as with some of the other things, didn't make it into our first draft. And all of them relate to, kind of put them in the category of fixes to the current system that will hopefully, constrain the liability, the growth of the unfunded liability, and at least help us predict it better going forward. And as I go through this, I'd just like to ask either Kathy Lee or Melanie, if I say anything that's incorrect, please feel free to come up and whack me or correct the record.
They could just correct you.
The first issue, Madam Chair, is the refunded accounts. And if you look on page 3, and basically what a refunded account is anybody who's worked for the state or one of the employers that use our PERS and TERS system but has left service, not retired, but has terminated for one reason or another, and chose to take the money they had contributed into the system out with them. That's a refunded account. So the division is not maintaining an account for them that has any money in it, but we do have records of who's left. Under the current system, those members have a right to come back into the system at some point into the future, reestablish that account, pay the indebtedness back into the system, so the amount they refunded with accumulated interest, and continue to serve if needed, or immediately leave the system if they were already vested and get the benefit that they're owed due to their service. So on page 3, just to give you an idea of the magnitude, there's roughly 77,000 of these people out there, and it's broken out here by the system and by the tier, primarily because for tier 1, you see that for tier 1 you vest in 5 years, and tier 1 you vest in PERS and TERS it's 8. So we've got a total of 5,600 people, members, that can be rehired today, pay this indebtedness, and work for a day and leave the system and draw their full benefit, which, as we've been discussing for several weeks, is a pretty significant benefit. And the reason this is a problem is because it's what I kind of refer to as an off-balance sheet liability, in that we have no idea how many of these people intend to exercise this option, and so none of these things are built into the actuarial analysis that determines the 5.7 liability that we currently have. And obviously, if these people terminated early in their career, and as they approach retirement age and start thinking about retirement and realizing the value of those medical, those system-paid medical benefits, they can come back into the system, pay a relatively small amount of indebtedness relative to the benefit they're going to draw over their life expectancy. So if you go to the next page.
Madam Chair. Senator Bundy.
Under, again, our constitutional limitations, if someone was eligible for a Tier 1, even if they weren't vested, and then they return to employment for the state, this scenario you mentioned could play out. Can we change the rules for someone who was Tier 1, isn't invested, cashed out, but if they return to employment, so they'd be eligible for what you mentioned there? Would it be considered unconstitutional to change the rules for those people, even though they're not vested and they're cashed out?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, this is one of the issues that you will get different opinions on depending on who you talk to. I think that's certainly one side of it. We, in drafting the plan for the new tier, I think Tracy went over this morning, although the concepts are a little bit different under the new tier, in the language as it is now, if you are a member and leave the system for the HRA, you have the right to come back within 5 years and reestablish that account. In that instance, the employer was putting in all the money, so when you left, you didn't take any of it. But, you know, if you've worked for 5 or 10 years and earned a balance in that account, decided to go on a sabbatical or travel around or have a child and come back into the system, we thought 5 years was a reasonable period. So using that analogy, what our proposal was with this was to state kind of some legislative intent in this language that said it's the intent of the legislature to repeal this 5 years from now and to recognize that this is a benefit that's out there, but if you have not exercised it within the next 5 years, come back and reestablish that indebtedness. Don't necessarily have to pay it off, but show an intent to come back that we would at least be able to, at that point, measure our liability and start factoring it into our planning and our funding of the system. Whether that passes constitutional muster or not, I can't say, and that's why we wanted to bring it up today, because it is one of those things, and let the members decide whether we want to go forward with it or not.
I might add, well, and another way to skin this cat, I suppose, is these people can come back if they get hired. And if the various departments understand that it's going to, their personnel costs is going to go up and the legislature is going to not be generous in their funding, that might be a cork for this bottle, too.
And to follow up a little bit, Senator Bundy, through the chair, on chart four, that was the purpose of, or on page four, of showing, I think the division will tell you that have about a 2% of this population has come back, or that's roughly about the amount that's been coming back. But part of that is just the demographics of it. If you look, this is a age distribution of these 77,000 people, and it's a pretty standard bell curve, but I kind of bracketed there the retirement range for early retirement for these tiers between 50 and 60, and there's 27,000 people in that category. So there's 27,000 people who are approaching the age that they're going to start seriously considering their medical costs going forward, and realizing that this is a pretty rich plan, and consider coming back in and doing this. And there are several people working in this building this session that fall into this category who have come back and realized, you know, this is a benefit, and they're paying into it. And so the other, just to illustrate, there's another handout here that is information provided by the division. It looks like a spreadsheet. And these are just actual examples of what we're talking about. These are individuals that have come back, exercised this option, and just, and you can take this back and look it over, but I wanted to point out a couple examples. Eight lines down, I'm sorry I didn't number this, but eight lines from the top there, there's this age 60. Actually, the easier way is over in the comment section. It's the second comment down. It says worked less than 1 month. And if I could walk you through that. So this is an individual who was tier one. They retired at age 60. They were working for the state of Alaska. Now, if you move over to the total service column, when they left the system, they had 5.37 years of service. So this person was actually vested when they left the system, and they left it on April 30th of 1971. They refunded out in November of that year, so they chose to take their money out of the system. They were rehired in June 26th of 2002, and they paid the system back the next month. They retired less than a month later, or they left the system less than a month after being rehired, and now have full system paid medical benefits. Another example, a little further down on the right comments, you'll see five legislative sessions, and I wanted to bring this one up because I think if we haven't talked about it already, there is language in our bill to address kind of a collateral issue to this one. And on this example, person had total service was 1.67 years. They left the system in 1981, were rehired in 01, paid their refund the next year, August 26th of 2002, and left the system basically what it looks like a little over a year after they entered it. And in this instance, this individual worked five legislative sessions and accrued, and under the five session rule that's in statute now, you only have to, a session is considered 60 days, not 120 days in statute. So one of the things in our bill is to move that 60 to 120.
Mr. Baker, there must be an error here.
Yeah.
Because under comments, there's one that says worked one day, and a couple lines down, worked one day. So
1 week, and then one day, and 1 week.
Could you address the 1 day?
Sure. Go down, actually, not just because I've highlighted, not that it matters, but I highlighted the one that says worked one day that's right below the worked 1 week.
Okay.
So there's a worked 3 months, worked 1 week, and then there's a worked 1 day. So let's take that worked 1 day. This individual had 10 years of service, left in 1988. They took their money out 5 years later. In January of 2003, they came back in October of 2003, they were rehired, and they paid the refund in December of 2003. And if you're trying to do the math, I don't know that you're going to be able to do the math here, but maybe Melanie or Kathy Lee can speak to it, but this spreadsheet isn't meant to show the exact math, but I do know that in this instance, this person came back, worked for 1 day, because in order to pay the indebtedness, they had to come back, establish the account, pay it back, and then they left the system after a day. And the employers don't necessarily know this information. If they're looking for somebody to fill a job, they're going to go out and hopefully look for the best person and hire somebody. The standard kind of interview process doesn't necessarily address this issue. Of course, the challenge is this employer then picks up, you know, as we've discussed over the last several weeks, it's for PERS, these liabilities are carried individually by the employer. So the employer is going to share with whoever this person's previous employer was. That liability going forward proportionally, there will be so if he worked, this person had worked 10 years for the state and worked that last 1 day in that instance for the municipality of Anchorage, for example, the municipality would be picking up a very small percent in this case because it's just 1 day. But 1 day, the percentage that 1 day represents of I guess 3,690 days, which would be 10 years.
Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Miles, I guess the scenario wouldn't be too outlandish if we said that the employer, knew that this 59-year-old was going to come to work for one day and leave.
I don't know, that, Senator Wilken, through the chair, I don't know the names and addresses, sir.
I understand, but I'm just saying sometimes it could be the employer does have knowledge of this particular person's needs and would hire accordingly, whether it's in the best interest of the municipality or the state. And I'd suspect that that's probably what happened with that particular one.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
I understand the Tier 1s. Can you explain what benefit there was for a Tier 2 to come back to service? Like the second one, age 60. Why are they listed here?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I mean, although the benefit, and I don't have my sheet for the difference between the tiers, but the benefits, although they're different between Tier 1 and Tier 2, they're still fairly substantial. I think it's just a difference between the age at which the full system medical kicks in is slightly different, but there would still be a significant medical benefit that somebody would certainly, and an example might be that your indebtedness, let's say your entire indebtedness, at least for somebody who had only worked about, let's say, 5 years, and indebtedness might be $4,500 maybe that you pulled out of the system with interest, and you go off into private sector, work another career, make a nice living, come back, pay that $4,500 with interest, and then retire and get the state's medical plan. The estimates I've seen, that $4,500 will be paid back the first year for you. So for the next 15 years of life expectancy, your return on that $4,500 investment, so to speak, is huge. Because the system, because that person wasn't putting in all that time, the system has not had time to recoup the money that that individual will be drawing out of the system.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And looking at these rehire dates, the majority of them are after 2000. It looks like this is mostly a fairly current trend. And I'm guessing now that we're discussing it, it will become a more well-known trend, and we could have a huge rush. Again, the only limit will be whether there are openings. Thank God we're not trying to hire a bunch more state employees this year. Oh, no, we are, aren't we? Oh. Not me, but somebody in this building. And in the legislature, and I think the departments have to be very aware that they could be contributing to a serious increase in this deficit that we've, the 5.7 or whatever amount it is, deficit. Is there any way to monitor this thing on a monthly basis or something, that if we see that there's a land office rush here, that there might be some way to dampen it down?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, and if the division has any comments on any of this, please come up. But in terms of whether this is representative of the history of the program, I don't know, because I don't know what time period. These were just meant to be examples. I do think it's fair to assume, based on this demographic distribution that's on page 4, that this is a issue that's going to become more relevant, just because the tier one folks and the early tier two folks are definitely approaching these retirement ages. To your point about whether people at home are taking notes and now realize they have a benefit that they didn't realize, And that was discussed as we discussed this issue, whether bringing it to light was good or bad. The division, as part of their standard education of the membership, constantly talks about this benefit. I mean, it is a benefit. It is out there. It's in their newsletters. So the assumption was that people they know about this benefit, and they certainly have a right to try to exercise it if they have a skill that employers want and they have an ability to get the job back.
Senator Bundy.
I'm wondering if we could ask Melanie to join us again, and I could address a question to her, that whether you're aware if this is a growing trend or not.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we just pulled the data for the last 5 years, so we haven't gone back beyond that time period. So we could certainly do that to find out if this trend is increasing or decreasing, and we would be happy to do so. One thing that I think it's important as we look at our PERS and TERS system and we make comparison with other retirement systems is that the indebtedness provisions with PERS and TERS is atypical compared to other pension systems. So this is a unique situation that does create an unfunded liability to our systems that most other systems do not have that type of provision. Once you refund out of most retirement systems, it extinguishes your right to go back and reclaim a much earlier entitlement to those benefits. So I think that's important for us to recognize that it's unique to our systems.
Continue.
And I know everything's constitutional until it goes to court. But do you have an opinion as to whether we can make a change about people who have refunded?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we have looked at that issue, and we.
So you have or haven't?
We have looked at that issue, and we believe while our Department of Law certainly would need to weigh in on that, but. It's possible that by looking at that five-year period, even though it may subject the state to some legal challenge, that you also, by allowing that five-year period, you may mitigate against those damages. So.
Madam Chair, it's been said here before that this wasn't a perfect storm, but between the current deficit, what we heard about the lawsuit, and now the rush to reclaim, perhaps, that could exist. I think that clouds are certainly gathering.
They are. Senator Shedman.
Just to add on to Senator Bundy's comment before I ask mine, there's a couple more skeletons laying around.
Storms.
I think I'm going to go home.
Yeah, I know. Too depressed?
Back in my office and drink like the rest of them.
Melody, on page one, oh, about an inch off the bottom, there's entry age 73, no idea on the last contribution date, but it looks like the date of the refund was 1969, and the individual worked for less than 1 month. On page three, about in the center, there's an entry on age 51. Kind of in the center of the whole table. Looks like that individual, again, worked for 1 day. His date of last contribution was 1980, and the refund was 4/30/1980. Even if, you know, I guess if we do a time horizon of 5 years to kind of phase this out, is there, and I certainly don't want to put any policies in place that will disadvantage past workers, because some of them are, you know, have a lot of skills and they certainly should be equally ranked and treated in the hiring process. But is there mechanisms that can be put in place to try to stop the abuse? I mean, it seems to me like, you know, when a worker comes in for 1 day, you don't even have time to put your wife's picture on the table before you're gone. And I think that at least should be a minimum requirement.
you've got to hang pictures in your office or you don't get the benefit.
It's kind of a, I guess, a sarcastic way of asking the question, but is there, you know, performance or employment time horizons or something that can be worked out or or looked at? And so it's, you know, it's fair to the employee and fair to the employer.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think that by heightening the awareness about these types of issues, that the state of Alaska as an employer through the Division of Personnel can make hiring managers aware of this type of situation. And I think what Senator Wilkin alluded to earlier is that if a hiring manager who has the authority to hire an individual, and if it's for the express purpose of advantaging an individual for one day of service, I think you deal with that issue as an employer, because I think the hiring manager, if they've engaged in some type of communication with a member and they understand the liability to the system, I think they're culpable. And I think that that is reckless to have those types of things happen. But I think you deal with those things through education, through talking to the hiring managers, through making them aware, and through ensuring that the parties who would engage in that type of behavior would not do so and create that kind of liability to the system.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Melanie, I went to page 2 and I found out, I saw one here that is Fairbanks North Star Rural School District. If I wanted to dive into that and find out who that person was that was 70 years old with less than 10 years of service, came back and worked one day, would I be able to get that file without a name on it to see the circumstances?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, the particulars contained in this data and the individual actions that have taken place, you wouldn't be able to get the information because that information is protected and confidential. Mm-hmm. So in
so
response
I wouldn't be able to find out, I don't care about their name, but the circumstances, what job he or she went to and why he or she quit or was terminated the next day. Couldn't get that information.
Let me check. May I ask Kathy to respond?
Are you looking for a lawyer?
You want Kathy to come forward?
Yeah, I would like to just know.
Come on, Kathy.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it'd be interesting to note also if there are clusters or there are certain departments that are seem to be more convenient for this to happen than others.
Well, I think it's particularly fascinating when you look back to the one where it was 1975 as the last date of work, or 80, or, yeah. I mean, and some of these people were barely over 25 the last time they worked in government service, and then they've come back, and with the one-day magic rule. But okay, go ahead. Kathy Lee, if you just give your name.
Okay, for the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, working with the employer, we would be able to advise the employer of which employee this was, and then they would be able to give you some information on the employee that worked one day. So if we work with the employer, we could, between the two of us, provide that information without disclosing which employee it was.
Okay. Then I would like to see that that particular case that is the age 70 on page 2 of 3. 2, 4, 7 up from the bottom.
Okay.
And I don't want you to spend days doing this, okay? Just an hour or two. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Kathy?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. The acronym, is that some school district?
Which one?
The one that Senator Wilkins referred to. FNSBSD?
Fairbanks North Star Borough School District.
Aha. Already my suspicions grow.
Madam Chair,
yes, sir.
What is the acronym ASD?
Almost the school district.
Oh, my word. Okay. Any other questions for Kathy regarding the legalities? Thank you.
Madam Chair, if we go to page 5, we've kind of touched on this, but this is of the three things I was going to talk about. This one actually is in the copy of the bill that we're discussing today. It's section 111 on page 90, and it would repeal this provision that allows you to come back in and pay your indebtedness with an effective date of June 30th, 2010.
And again, if I may, Madam Chair, being cautious for legal reasons to include the 5-year window, I'm not sure why we want to allow 5 years when we've got a peak of people that are probably now well informed and may, knowing that we're closing the window, may be even more encouraged to attempt to use the system.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, clearly this whole issue should be one that the members would want to discuss, and we discussed it in prior to putting it in, and I think, you know, the options at this point are everything from, you know, pulling it out and not including it in the final bill, repealing it without a window, or moving that window. I think the discussions we had were that, you know, clearly this falls into that category of benefit that somebody will argue is an accrued benefit, and that if you left the system, you may have loved your job, you may have loved what you were doing, and for whatever reason you left, this may have been one of the things that pushed you finally over to say, okay, I'll leave because I can always come back. And so the feeling was that if we're just at least up front and saying that our intention is to recognize that this is a benefit and recognize that it may take you a while to find a job back with one of these employers, that 5 years was a reasonable window, but that the legislature would be making it clear that our intent is to get rid of this over the long term.
Is there anything magic about 5 years?
Madam Chair, not to my recollection. Others that were part of debate might have it. I think, but I think it is more equitable given that we've kind of added a 5-year provision to the new tier in terms of the HRA portion, which is the only thing that's kind of similar.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sure we will, and I just want to encourage getting some legal opinions on this. I think it might be well advised to limit this window as much as we can.
I would think so, too. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Go ahead, Miles.
Okay, the next of the three topics, which hits a little closer to home, but I think it's worth a point of discussion, and Kevin Ritchie mentioned it from the Alaska Municipal League earlier this morning, and that's just the issue that the legislature does have the ability to, we have, as we're learning, very limited ability to go back and reduce benefits, but there's certainly the ability to increase them. And once that's done through legislation, it's very hard to undo. And so we wanted to address that, and this is something that's not in the bill, but Mr. Ritchie touched on it, and that's that recognize that the fiscal note process that's currently in place may not be sufficient for legislation that affects benefits. And the example on page 7 is HB 242, which was passed in 2001, which in effect gave Tier 1 medical benefits to Tier 2 employees, or a portion. Tier 2 employees weren't eligible for system-paid medical until the age of 60, whereas Tier 1 employees are. And so HB 242 had the effect of moving a whole, in a sense, a whole group of folks from Tier 2 to Tier 1 on that, for that portion of their benefit. When the legislation was being debated, the estimated system liability at that time was $23.7 million. But that number and that amount didn't show up anywhere in the fiscal note that was submitted to the bodies at that time. And, you know, if it had been, and certainly people at least could acknowledge that if they passed the legislation, they realized it was going to have an impact, and how could that be funded? Since that time, the bill did pass. Since that time, as we were learning at this table, medical costs are continuing to go up. The current, we had the impact of this specific piece of legislation looked at again, and that liability has now grown to $37.7 million. So clearly, there needs to be something done, perhaps, for legislation that affects benefits, to tweak the fiscal note process so that the members can at least have a clear fiscal forecast when they deliberate about new pieces of legislation. And in this session, this year, there are several pieces of legislation that fall into this category, and I've just listed a few here. HB 6 would put fish and wildlife enforcement officers into the police category, which is a 25 and out type of program. HB 40 gives police officers, and this bill was also around last year. I think it was in the Senate. It was SB 91, I believe, last year. I may be mistaken. Would move the system-paid medical from 25 to 20 years of service. And SB 21 this year is suggesting that child and vulnerable adult protection workers be added to the police employee class.
Senator Bundy?
There's another bill out there that does something about pre-existing conditions, or actually allows for an easier medical claim for firefighters, I think, and that might also have an impact on what you're saying. And while I've met a few fish and wildlife officers who I think will calm, I think probably what you're trying to say is they're going to claim credit on under SB 6 there.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, this is not an exhaustive list. There are other pieces of legislation. In fact, the division has a link on their website where they always list any legislation that affects the retirement system, the retirement systems, not in a good way, a bad way, just anything that affects the system. And there's a list of things there this year.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, if and when these bills would come before us, I would think this committee's responsibility would be remiss if we didn't put a realistic fiscal note on them. Something that in the neighborhood of
the only thing that would
5.7
be
million.
Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, Miles, also I would think that Senate Bill 24 probably goes on that list, if I'm not mistaken.
Retire, rehire?
Yeah, the retire, rehire bill. So just to put it on our radar screen. I think that bill is in this committee now. So.
Or is it judiciary?
Okay.
Go ahead.
So on page 8, Madam Chair, is the proposed fix. This is not in our legislation yet, but my understanding there would maybe an amendment put forth tomorrow on this issue would be just to enhance our fiscal note reporting procedures. The 5-day process is not sufficient, and to require that there be some sort of actuarial analysis, I think, Senator Wilkin mentioned that maybe 60-day, a 60-day grace period of analysis may not take 60 days, but that you would give these pieces of legislation at least 60 days or something like that to be analyzed. Just to kind of put a finer point on the bill I used as an example from 2001, the fiscal note at that time, there was a fiscal note, but it didn't have a dollar amount. It simply said that, and I'm quoting here, that this bill will increase PERS and TERS employer rates a modest 0.17% of payroll. So anyone that just wasn't immersed in what all that meant would look at a 0.17% increase and perceive it as being modest, but when you actually apply that to the payroll and then project those additional costs out and bring them back to present day value, it's $37 million.
I should ask you who signed that fiscal note, but I won't, so go ahead.
The last of the three topics, and Senator Wilkin had asked earlier what a PERPA was, I believe, yesterday, and that's the post-pension retirement adjustment. And if you can go to page 10, there really are two, you could say, pension adjustments in our system right now. The first is the COLA, and we had some testimony yesterday about that. And the second is what's called a post-pension retirement adjustment. And both of these are meant to inflation-proof, if you will, your pension payment. The post-pension retirement adjustment was established in 1966, and the language was really what we're now calling the discretionary ad hoc. You'll hear it referred to as either or, but that language was established in 66, and the idea was that it allowed the administrator of the system, which is appointed by the commissioner, and Melanie Milhorn is the administrator today. If the administrator determined that the cost of living had increased, that may issue an adjustment if the condition of the financial condition of the retirement trust permits, but didn't describe what the criteria was for permitting. The cost of living adjustment is easy to determine because that's done on a regular basis, and Anchorage is used as the area, but it left some discretion as to whether the financials, whether the fund could support an adjustment. At some point later into the future, the may was changed to shall, which had the effect of making this a required pension adjustment, and then recognizing that, you know, as the tier system came out, when the new tiers came into effect, for PERS in 1986 and for TERS in 1990, the legislature actually repealed this provision and replaced it, which was with very similar language in a sense, or the concept, and it was what's now referred to as the automatic PRPA. So they took, the idea was, let's take the discretion away and recognize that we should inflation-proof the pension, and let's make it an automatic so that we can actuarially determine the liability going forward instead of making it discretionary, and set some stricter limits on the eligibility requirement. But because all of the Tier 1 employees had had this benefit previously, the ad hoc provision is still the one that's used to determine the adjustment for Tier 1, and they're given the larger benefit of the either-or if you're a Tier 1 employee. So if you go to the next page, page 11, it kind of gives you the particulars. I think the simplest way to look at it is that the ad hoc applied to all retirees. If you were retired and an ad hoc was awarded, everyone got it. When the automatic language was put into effect, there was an attempt to limit that a little bit and limit the eligibility pool, and they basically said you've got to at least be 60 or have been receiving your benefits previously. So if you did have an early retirement, you still had to have been in retirement for 5 years if you were PERS and 8 years, or if you were anybody on disability was getting them automatically. So there was an attempt to limit it a little bit. And the other thing it did is the ad hoc had a 4% cap on the increase. The new language took the Anchorage CPI and gave you 50% of that, 50% of the change if you were in the broad category, and it gave you 75% of the change if you were 65 and over or disabled. So the issue, so the fundamental issue is that the discretionary automatic is working. It's applied every year. The actuaries have trends for what the growth of the economy is going to be. We know what the formula is, and we can plug that into the models, and it is plugged into the models when you're computing the liabilities. The issue with the ad hoc is that it's discretionary. You don't know when it's going to be awarded, and the mechanism for how it's computed is that it takes, so let's say it's not awarded for several years, and then it is awarded. It's not an increment over just that year. What it does is it goes, for each of the retirees, goes back to the date they were retired, and it gives them up to a maximum of 4%. All of the accrued CPI adjustments from the date they retired. So it has the effect of making people whole all the way up to a 4% cap, whereas under the current system, the most you can ever get in any 1 year is 50% of the CPI for that year, which is rarely over 4%. It's typically more like 1.5 or 2 total, so you'd get 50% of that. And in addition to that, if it is awarded for the ad hoc, the Tier 1, it goes back and kind of keeps making you good on all the things you missed up until that 4%.
But doesn't the provision and that the financial condition of the retirement fund permits sort of act as a dampener?
Which takes us right to the crux of the issue, Madam Chair, which is that it's at the discretion of the administrator. I think from the time the ad hoc PRPA was put in place in 1960 up until the time it was repealed, it had been awarded, I think, all but 2 years. After it was repealed in 1990 and 1991, it was not awarded, and I think from some of the other handouts we've had, I don't have mine in front of me, you could go back and look at what this funding ratio of the accounts were during the 90s, 1990 and 1991, but the commissioner decided not to award it. In 1991, there was a lawsuit filed, class action lawsuit, on this issue, and it wasn't settled until 1996, so basically from 1990 up until the settlement of 1996, they continued to not award the PRPA, the ad hoc. The state lost that lawsuit, and if you, or I shouldn't say they lost it, there was a settlement reached. If you go to page 13, I'm going to skip a page for a minute. Go to page 13, this kind of gives you what happened, that the 95 and the 96, the 96 is when the lawsuit was settled, and it basically, the terms of the suit required that in 1997, the state pay the settled amount, which went back and I think set some limits. It was less than the 4%, but it went back and made whole these Tier 1 retirees, and you see there that it had the effect, the cumulative effect, and then going forward for the employers, had the percentage total monthly, this is a monthly increase in retirement payments of $5.1 million. I didn't do the 12-month cash increase there because it would not be accurate since that year it was particularly large because they were trying to go back and make good. But on the in the next several years, 98, 99, 2000, the PRPA was awarded, and those are the years that, as you'll recall from some of the testimony over the last couple weeks, were the years that we had were showing a funding ratio between, you know, for PERS it was 105, 106, 105, 105, and in TERS it was in the high 90s, 97, 94, 97, and it was awarded in those years, and now we know that for a variety of reasons the fund really probably wasn't funded to that level. And you see, you will see there that in 98, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, you see the amounts that were awarded, and you see in the far right column the resulting actuarial loss to the system as a result of those ad hoc PRPAs. So these are the actuarially computed loss. So we had a cumulative, if you add all those together, you're looking at 100 plus million dollars of immediate unfunded liability that went to the system. And the reason it's an immediate unfunded liability for the most part is that the system was not set up to accept the fact that for all of those individuals, those Tier 1 individuals who got this award, that for the rest of their pension life expectancy, they're now getting a bigger monthly payment. So when you forecast out that new amount, bring it back to today's dollars, it's this much more that the system would have had to have in order to be prepared to pay those out. And that's why the ad hoc is particularly deadly, if you will, because it's an unfunded liability going.
Thank you, Miles. That total is $143.5 million. That's a substantial amount of money. I think what concerns me and is going forward right now, I think everybody would conclude that we're definitely underfunded, and hopefully there won't be any ad hoc PAs paid out for a substantial many years until such time as a fund becomes near fully funded. The concern I have is if it takes us 15 years to get there, just hypothetically as a number, to get the fund up to 95 or 100% funded, and they go ahead and award an ad hoc PRPA, from what Mr. Baker was saying, it's a cumulative lost increase, so they would go back to when they last paid it, even though we may be underfunded for a period of 20 years, picking up the last few in the next 15, and we're going to get slammed with a huge payment.
Who figured that out? I mean, that's incredible. Was it probably the problem of the court? Well, and that the settlement or the decision, or because
who figured out how to apply the ad hoc?
Rhetorical. I was really being, you know, crass, but.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could, the interesting thing is this, and I'm certainly And again, if I'm misstating anything, I hope the division will correct me, but just in my quick tutelage on this whole issue, this is an example of a simple may to shall change created a big problem. The initial language was may, so it gave even more discretion. So it still didn't define, it never defined what the financial health of the system needed to be to award it, but in addition it said may award, and at some point, and I don't remember the date, there was, the legislature changed it to shall, and then that created, you know, that created a situation where even without defining what the funding condition was, that this should be awarded. So it has not been awarded in the last 2 years. The fix, I will back up if you'd like to page 12 and 10 and kind of walk you through an example, but the fix, the last page on page 14, the proposed fix is that we would include language that defines what the financial condition of the retirement fund is. So not repeal the ad hoc PRPA. It technically already has been repealed and replaced with the new automatic, but would go back and clarify, give a definition to financial condition. The CPI is factual. We know what it is. It's an economically determined number, but the funding level is fairly, you know, it's discretionary of who's looking at it. You know, for the deliberation of the members, in my conversations with some of the people that are more familiar with the issue in the lawsuits, was that the funding level of PERS in 1995, the total benefit funding level in 1995 was 94.8%. And for TERS, it was 89.6%. And the ad hoc PRPA was not awarded that year, but the lawsuit, as a result of the lawsuit, there was an award applied later for that year that was paid out in 1997. So there could be an argument made that through that settlement, the state has kind of made part of the record the determination that 94.8% or perhaps even 89.6% is an acceptable funding level to issue an ad hoc PRPA.
And can you define it more clearly in statute? So that helps?
Again, Madam Chair, I'm not a legal expert at all, but we're proposing that we define it and establish it for discussion purposes at 110%.
Or the PRPA.
If the systems were not funded, the total funding ratio was not at least 110%, then the health of the system is not healthy enough that in addition to the normal PRPA, which everyone automatically gets, that we would go back and award an ad hoc PRPA for Tier 1 employees.
Should there also be anything about retroactive? Going back and covering all those years when it wasn't covered, if you...
Well, Madam Chair...
If you suddenly get to 110, and then they say, well, then that takes it up. Is that the new base, or is that just a one-time... See, because I don't see why that would be the new base. To me, that should be the condition of that year, not the new floor.
110%, Madam Chair, would be the new... That would be the number that every year when the division did these calculations, they get the Anchorage CPI, they figure out what it is. That determines what the automatic PRPA will be for the coming benefit year. They also do the ad hoc numbers, and they would look at the actuarial reports. And if we are 110% funded, which as Senator Stedman has testified, we are a long way from ever being there. But in case we ever are there again, and hopefully we will be, that the fund would have to be very overfunded before this would be awarded. The issue with changing how the calculation is made, I think, would be less defensible because it was very clear in statute how the calculation was done, and it was a maximum of 4%, and it went back to the date the member retired and looked cumulatively over the entire CPI increase from that date. So
I don't know if I can stand any more good news.
Please tell me your skeleton closet is empty. At the risk of repeating myself, my friend, who I alluded to the other day, retired commissioner, retired trooper, his check that he received in the mail, unbeknownst to him, he just opened the mail, and there was a check for over $300,000, 1997.
Whoa.
So these were not insignificant adjustments.
We wonder why there's an unfunded liability. Senator Bundy.
And at a far different pay grade, if I remember correctly, as a Tier 1 retiree, I got a check for $2,000 or $3,000. And no one, it was one of those class action that you never knew you were part of, and all of a sudden, wow, Alaska must be rich. They're giving away money.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, I'm not sure if I answered your question completely. My understanding is there really isn't a way for us to make a change that would prevent us from having to ever go back and make these people whole, because that's just how the PRPA works, the mechanics of it. To Senator Stedman's point, even though the Department of Administration has been showing good fiscal constraint the last 2 years and saying, no, we can't award this, for some reason, if we quickly got to a funding level of 100%, once it's awarded, if it's ever awarded again, the mechanics of how it works basically go back to, for each of those retirees that are eligible for this, the Tier 1s, goes back to the date they retired, adds up the entire cost of living, the inflation, basically, from the date they retired to the date of the award, and subtracts out of that previous awards, and then has the effect of, and then up to the 4% cap per year, has the effect of. So in other words, if even though the CPI for that year might be 1.5%, if an ad hoc got awarded that year as well, and it hadn't been awarded for several years, chances are that most of the Tier 1 employees would get a full 4% bump, because they cumulatively they would have had more than the 1.5, or the 50% of the 1.5 that everyone else gets as part of the automatic.
How many Tier 1 employees are there?
I think I wrote that number down.
28,000 total retirees, 28,000 plus.
24,500, roughly. And
that is the most destructive plan. I mean, because if you get ahead, then you automatically have to pay.
Madam Chair?
Overpay any calculation you ever had. Yes, sir.
Yeah, and this determination of this payout is dependent on the administration, not on the Pays and Tourism Board.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, the statute says that the administrator, who is appointed by the department, or the commissioner, makes the determination. My understanding is that, at least how this administration has been doing it, is the boards who are the first ones to really see the actuarial analysis. So they're the first ones in the process who will know what the new funding status is, are expected to make a recommendation one way or the other to the department. It's probably interesting to note that for the 05 PRPA, the boards made no recommendation one way or the other. know where the funding status is, so I could, but the way it would work is the boards would make a recommendation, and then the division, the administrator division of retirement benefits notifies the commissioner, you know, here are the stats, we need your say on whether we should do this, and it has not been awarded in the last 2 years, and I think it hasn't been challenged because it's hard to make the argument now that the financial condition of the fund would permit it, but as we've seen in the past, even at an 85% funding level, there were people that successfully argued that it should have been.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's mind-boggling, but and I don't mean to that my questions should cast any aspersion on the Department of Division of Retirement and Benefits. They were simply obeying the law based on information for the actuarial information they were getting. To Senator Stedman, do actuarial firms have errors in admissions insurance? Because it sounds like we have a few errors here.
I think the answer to that is yes, but on this, as far as I'm sure they have E&O insurance, error and omission, but I think what makes this topic more of a bear trap to us is it's cumulative as we don't pay it. The language is so embedded and so clear, it's very difficult for us to use rational business practices in managing a plan. In other words, you wouldn't pay it if you're substantially underfunded. At some point, the goal is to get the fund totally funded. Right now we're rounded off at 70% underfunded, $5.7 billion. But when we close that gap, which is the goal, we're going to get hit with a huge liability
again.
And, you know, if it takes us 15 years to close it, and we haven't, I just, you know, extrapolated out, I ignored that first 50 million that was paid out and just took an average of those other like 4 or 5 years and took a guess, we're probably looking at $500 million, $400 million to $500 million. And you can rest assured there'll be, you know, attorneys looking for billable hours that'll be standing in line watching that funding ratio ready to pull the trigger and force us to pay it.
This doesn't distinguish, though, this distinguishes with the waning of the Tier 1 employee beneficiaries, retirees.
You know, I'm not an attorney, but if you have a vested benefit and you don't get it for a period of years and you pass away, I would just assume that would be an asset held by the estate. I mean, if I was taking care of someone's estate and I knew there was $300,000 laying out there, I'd hold the estate open and sit back and wait. And if I didn't, I think it would be a breach of my duty managing the estate.
Well, can you figure out a way to get us out of this?
Yeah, we're working on it, Madam Chair, very vigorously.
I appreciate that. We all appreciate that. Okay. You've wrapped up, Miles? Thank you. Okay. Senator Stedman, I think it's back in your court.
I think we are done for the day. Isn't that correct, Miles?
Except for the presentation by Melanie. Do you have one? No? Implementation? Come ahead. Thank you. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration.
Before we start, do we have a handout from you, or are we on our own?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think what we'll do is we wanted to talk to you generally about some of the implementation issues that we see, and then we would reduce those to a handout that we could add to packets at the earliest possible date. From the beginning, first before launching on a discussion of implementation, I too would wanted to take the opportunity to recognize the efforts of primarily Tracy and Miles, but also, you know, Senator Stedman and all the committee members for their diligent work and long hours, and also Melanie as well. I know that she's been working hand in hand and trying to provide, you know, information as best we can. Kathy Lee's on staff. So really it is a tribute to the people that are really investing a lot of their own time and effort to make this a successful project. So I wanted to recognize that.
Thank you.
Once a bill passes and it becomes law, you know, work starts for the division. And we've been, we sat yesterday and talked both with staff and the Division of Retirement Benefits, also with staff in our Division of Finance, because obviously the state is only one employer. We have about 155 PERS employers and another 56 or 7 TERS employers. And so we've sat and thought, what does this mean to the state as one of the largest employers? I know Kevin Ritchie talked about, I guess we make up maybe a third or so in that area of the total. But the implications of this bill will have far-reaching impacts throughout the state, to all the school districts and municipalities and other PERS employers. From the state's perspective, we would be making adjustments to the payroll system so that we could, you know, change employee withholdings and do things that we need to do with new hires coming into the system. I could probably take this opportunity, I'll only do it briefly, but in the capital budget you'll see a payroll rewrite, you know, an appropriation to do a payroll rewrite, because our payroll system is very old and so modifications to that system are difficult. When we talked about, I asked the folks in finance, what could you do for us by July 1? They just looked at me with big eyes and said, well, you know, the good news that we had earlier in the session is that we settled a lot of labor agreements. Mm-hmm. The bad news is we have to program all the changes that mm-hmm. went into those labor agreements into the mm-hmm. payroll system. So there's a lot of things going on mm-hmm. In that regard. We have a significant amount of work in standing up the different investment in accounting structures in the Division of Retirement Benefits as well. So there's a lot of things logistically that we will be working hard on. I think July 1 is probably an insurmountable date for us to have something going. Mm-hmm. In the school districts, and what we've done, some analysis on the hires, just to give you an idea. One of the first questions that came to our mind is, well, what could we expect? In a year, and I'll make this table available to the committee, but in the fiscal year 04, we had 4,362 new hires in all of PERS. Mm-hmm. And in TERS, it was 1,231. During the first 6 months of 05, July 1 to December 31, we had 2,862 new hires in PERS, 1,188 in TERS. One of the most significant things that struck me there was out of 1,231 hires in all of FY04 in TERS, we had 1,181 in a six-month period, which you would expect because you'd have everyone gearing up for the school year mm-hmm. and presumably bringing on staff by August or September for that school year. So obviously we would want to get this the new tier set up so that we could take employees into the new tier just as soon as possible, but we're going to be significantly challenged, and it's probably more dramatic on the TERS side in working with employers on that side of the retirement system. Another part of it is we've talked about that's part of this bill is the board reconfiguration, and again that would take time and identifying people. So we were looking at in rough terms that you could probably do the board part of this by October 1 in the first 90 days of the fiscal year and identify people and appoint them and go through the process of that. And that by January 1, we could do what we would need to do to set up the systems to accommodate the type of change that we're talking about with a deferred defined contribution.
Is there any way to speed up that time frame on the board? Because we have an ambitious, very ambitious mission, this new board, as an advisory to us in the next cycle. We are very concerned about getting a read on where we should be heading.
Madam Chair, this is one where it's really probably more the purview of the Department of Revenue, since that board would be housed in their department. I think the administration would endeavor to do and implement all of the provisions of the bill just as soon as possible and not delay in any way. When you look at the current makeup of those boards and some of the individuals, we heard Dr. Soley and the recent appointee, Carrie Jarrell, many of those people would fit the criteria that are contemplated in the new bill. And so, you might see some of the same faces. It's hard to say, but...
And I've advised many of them that they definitely want to reapply. And Tracy just said that we've addressed the transition in the CS.
Right, and I think that was my understanding as well.
Okay, thank you.
So those are generally some of the issues that we see in just trying to implement this. I could defer to Melanie if she had any other comments, or certainly try and answer any questions that members of the committee might have.
I have a question on, because of the, there's a fair number of people designated or slated to be hired based on the budget bills and the appropriations we've seen before us. Is there any way to make the hire, I'm under 204, as of date X, even if all the provisions of Tier 4 are not completed?
Madam Chair, I think that is something that we would like to look at, because we actually talked about that very concept. Mm-hmm. Could we just establish the tier?
Anyone hired after date X is Tier 4, or on effect on or after is Tier 4.
Right, and then so what we immediately started thinking, well, the Tier 4 contemplates a defined contribution similar to SBS. Mm-hmm. Maybe we would just have to say during the startup phase, the only investment option for your defined contribution is the Alaska Balance Fund or T-bills or something that's very low risk, and until we can get this set up, and then
be shifted to that.
Then employees would have the opportunity to switch. Mm-hmm. Really, I think the state, we could identify that. Again, our concern is I can't sit here and speak for all the employers out there and how they would bring these people on, how they would report their, set up their withholdings, submit those to the state, report them to us. I mean, that's an impact on several large employers like the Anchorage, the municipality or the school district up there, and numerous smaller employers as well. Mm-hmm. We're concerned about how we deal with the school districts. The schools are going to be shutting down shortly after the session is over, and that summer period is when we would have to do a lot of the work with the school districts. Again, we will make every effort to get it set up and do interim measures where we could set it up and then try and do the figure out the accounting or allocate amounts to individual accounts as best we can. But
I appreciate that. Are there any other provisions or anything that you see that we've overlooked or haven't considered that needs to be included or any conceptual things, or you have 24 hours. I'm just kidding. We would like to try to get all that information.
I think one item, Madam Chair, that has come up and been discussed is, you know, we're waiting on a legal opinion to determine what we can do with current, you know, as far as changing the contribution for current employees. I think there are some legal issues there. Melanie, any other, I think other than what we've talked about, it's already on the record, I think.
Thank you. Senator Bundy?
Yeah. Is this what you handed out for us? And I see item, on the first page, item 150, terminated employees, zero. Is this a net increase that we've experienced, or surely there must be some people who have left the system?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, this is a list of employers, and I think this that number 150 is, you know, there's several on here with zero. We scrambled to put this together last night, and so it pulls a lot of inactives in here as well. I would just disregard that line.
And then just to my question, this is a net increase, or this is a...
this reflects hires into Tier 3 PERS and Tier 2 TERS during the time periods listed.
But we don't know how many left at the same time.
That's correct. This is new entrance. We're trying to get an idea of...
It helps.
We're trying to get an idea of how many we might expect to see during the next, you know, the period of time that begins with FY06. I mean, and what a delay in implementing, you know, what that might mean in the number of employees that we wouldn't be able to get into a new tier.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I look at this list, I see on 226 and on 285, you've got two city of Hooperville. Since it happened to be in my district, I was wondering how to interpret that.
Which numbers did you say?
It's 226 and 285.
We're not on here.
Through the chair, and Senator Olson, again, I can't comment specifically. These are, the number there is the PERS employer number. There must be a second employer number.
Okay.
That's designated for the city of Hooper Bay. I'm not sure exactly what. We could certainly check into that, but I would, first brush, I would take the total of the two and view it as a single employer. But you'll see on here, for instance, there's many school districts that are in PERS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so you could have multiple employer numbers for a single municipality.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Kevin or Melanie? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just comment. I want to echo Kevin Brooks' earlier comments. This has been my first exposure to the legislative process and kind of to look behind the scenes, and it has been a remarkable process for me personally. I have watched Senator Green and Senator Stedman, Tracy Carpenter, and Miles Baker. I have watched them pore over every single word of this bill multiple times, all days Saturdays, all days on Sundays, and it has just been, for me, very professionally, a very rewarding experience, and I want to thank you.
Maybe not our pleasure.
Your pleasure.
That could be a misnomer. No, I've really been impressed with all the work that everyone has done. Can't say enough, and I feel privileged to be associated with these very, very talented people who have far more information about this than I do. Briefities. We are slated to be finished for today, we'll meet tomorrow at 12:30. And since we have only the amendments and the any talking we want to do about proposals or whatever to bring forward tomorrow at tomorrow's meeting, and then we'll try to have the rewrite ready for early in the week, and then we'll take it up again. And again, if any of you have specific amendments or conceptual amendments, now is a time to be talking. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you. And that was my question. If we had a couple of suggestions, if we should roll those out now or tomorrow.
roll them out now?
No.
Conceptually, there's some ideas?
Go ahead.
Okay. Turn to, on the new bill.
Version F.
Version F, if we could turn to page 9 and 40, specifically line 31 on page 39 through line 5 on 40. Mm-hmm. This has to do with the actuary, and the bill says today that we're going to audit that actuary not less than once every 4 years for the retirement portion and annually for the health cost person. And then on line 9, there's an independent audit of the state's actuary not less than once every 4 years. You know, one of the reasons, one of the clouds in our perfect storm is what I consider to be an actuary that hasn't served the state very well. And I say that with all respect, and I say it in hindsight, because we today have the benefit of that. And it may be too simple, but I'm going to offer it up. I wonder if we shouldn't be, I would hope when this process is over and the bill goes through here in another month, that the slate is wiped clean and we go out to the world market and find another actuary. Perhaps it's Mercer, perhaps it isn't, but I hope we start anew. And then once we know who that actuarial will be to advise us until the arrangement has changed, we then enter into what would amount to a peer review so that we have our primary actuary, and then we enlist, required to enlist what amounts to a backup or one that would review our primary, secondary, one that would review our primary actuary. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think that should be in statute. We pay, we saw here at the table, somewhere between $400,000 and $900,000 a year for this advice. We are managing $20 billion and we're managing people's lives. I think that we may be penny wise and pound foolish to leave all of the assumptions in one company and just take their word for what they consider to be the future. So I would just, I don't know how to put it in language, but I would like to have some thoughts from the committee to have a structure where we have a primary actuarial and we are required to have a secondary that enters into some sort of a peer review of the primary actuarial's recommendations.
Okay. Well, we'll kind of turn that over to you guys to maybe find the proper language for that, or would that be the appropriate, or do you want to discuss it? Okay. You want to respond? Did you want to respond?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess one thing I'd like to point out is that, in fact, we currently do employ that. We had, for instance, Milliman came in and audited Mercer to basically truth test the assumptions that were being used and so forth, and adjustments were made to Mercer's report based on Milliman's input. Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is that audit is currently done about every 4 to 5 years. Perhaps we would want to look at a greater frequency of doing that. Maybe it's annual, maybe it is a more automatic type of thing instead of every 4 or 5 years. But it is a method that's currently employed. It's just not as frequent as we might want to do it.
Well, it was one of the things we were certainly going to charge the new board with, was very definitely setting up the new, however, the hiring and their interviewing and the standard of what they want is for the actuary to be under review. And in fact, the folks had already said, because of very various reasons, that will be going back up for review and for bid in all likelihood, very near future. That doesn't take care of your concern. And so maybe we can figure out how to, is it more often? Because if you say that's already being done, then we may not need it in statute.
Can I respond to Kevin? Kevin, this is the chart that I think was most illustrative of what we're talking about. Decision was made in 95. The decision didn't get caught until someone decided to do an audit 6 years later. And that's when this whole system, for a year now, we've seen a sea change from 1 year to another. And that sea change happened right here.
And what I'm saying is that someone made this decision to go to the corridor method, probably exactly the right decision for that time. But the result of that wasn't uncovered until we got out to here, and now we're $5 billion in the hole. It seems like if we had somebody doing a peer review annually for whatever the number may be, $250,000, we wouldn't be in the fix that we are today. And so it's correct to say, yes, we do that today, but we do it on such a lag time that we have been burned by the current system, and I would hope we could tighten that up.
Well, let me ask you a question. Between the end of page 39 and lines 4 and 5 of page 40, does that duplicate that audit in lines 4 and 5? Does that bring in an extra audit that, in addition to what is talked about in 39? In lines 1, 2, and 3?
Well, except it says not less than once every 4 years.
And you would assume it's on the alternate years of the other 4 years. So that's...
Would it not? Is that what that means?
That is the peer review. That is the audit of the effort.
The frequency is more your concern?
I don't know. I think it's more than that. I think the primary actuary brings forward the assumptions that we've seen. We've marched through the assumptions, and they make recommendations. At that moment, a secondary actuarial, quite independent, looks at those and says, yeah, we think you're close, or no, you're misjudging health costs, you're misjudging mortality tables, whatever. It happens, one, two.
And okay, so you're talking about every audit that occurs, you want peer review of the audit?
No, it's not so much an audit. It's better called a peer review of the primary actuarial's suggestions.
Second opinion.
Second opinion, thank you. That's what it is. It's not looking backwards as an audit would look. It's looking forward to recommendations and the validity of those recommendations from quite a different an absolutely independent company that is in the same business. So that's what I see it as being. Now, and I'll say maybe we don't do that every year, but I certainly think we would be doing it every other year. And it may be just as efficient and cost us just as much money to do it every year rather than have somebody start from scratch every other year and ramp up to where they happen to be. But I'll leave that up to the experts. But anyway, that's the concept. If
I think Senator Stedman had a response.
Yeah, because I think what we're looking at is a second opinion on the annual assumptions and calculations. Maybe as a night, because we get into this lag time, maybe we should look at, just for a point of conversation, moving the actual audit down to every 3 years, and every other year have a peer review. That way, you know, we're not going to be stuck out very far before disagreement with a peer review, and then on the second year, and then the third year, have a full-blown audit, and you just keep rolling along. A four-year audit, I think Senator Wilkin has a very good concern that I would rather have us err being too tight for several years. We can always, you know, then lengthen it if we have to under the recommendations of the new board, then get in a position of having understated liabilities again.
Okay, do you have any ideas, Senator? Be thinking about what the language should be to accomplish what you're talking about and what Senator Wilkin is addressing, that concern. Because I think in this page, as you go down and talk about the different contract for an independent audit of the state's actuary, not less than once every 4 years, contract for an independent audit of the state's performance consultant, not less than one every 4 years, and this is in addition to the actuary, obtain an external performance review to evaluate the investment policies of each fund, and by the first day of each regular session, report to the governor, the legislature, and the individual employers participating in the state's retirement, a system of a pretty over-specific item. So we don't want to add
the belts, the fenders, the buttons, and the zipper, but...
It may not fit under this particular section. It doesn't have to be one of these paragraphs that are under powers and duties of the board. It may be at a different place in here. This was the only place I could find that we talked about reviews and things.
Okay. Well, let's see what we can figure out. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, another, as long as we're talking conceptual, I had mentioned a concern a while back. It's addressed on page 37 about the qualities or qualifications of members of the system, and I had suggested that both the public, the PERS and the TERS member not have to have the expertise that we are expecting others to have, and I don't see that that's been addressed yet.
And I don't know if they, it was an oversight or not, but I don't happen to agree with you, because I would hate to be that sixth and seventh member who came onto the board in a crowd of our ninth, eighth and ninth member who came into an actuary, a financial auditor, a professional, and then business managers and people who were very knowledgeable, and two commissioners, and not have any knowledge of the subject. And I'm not sure, and I don't want to disparage any level teacher or any subject matter. I would see that some knowledge or some background in or interest, and even professed, I mean, I wouldn't say you'd have to be a CPA or a fiduciary, you know, counselor or whatever, but somehow have either background or interest or something, some way we define that that person is not just the most popular person that can be found. Because I think in listening to some of the conversations from previous years, we've had some very, very, very strong members who, with experience and knowledge, who've been able to fairly or unfairly influence. And I don't want that to happen or be have anyone subject to that. I want them to be comfortable in the role.
And maybe you're having a broader definition than I was reading in. It currently reads they who are professionally credentialed or have recognized competence in investment management, finance, banking, economics, accounting, pension administration, actuarial analysis. Now, an active interest in that, is that a recognized competence?
I don't know. I mean, we might have to adjust something, but I don't think you want teacher X who's never invested, who does not know the difference in a normal cost rate. I know how long it's taken me just to get the lingo. And I think it'd be a great disadvantage to come in and not have any knowledge or any professed interest or economics, accounting. I think we need to think about it.
I understand that professed interest, that would cause me no heartburn at all. But to have recognized competence, I certainly accept and recognize the abilities of Dr. Soley. But he's only one of what?
Oh, but I think you have many of your peers who are teachers who invest their own accounts, who were very knowledgeable through experience, you know, and if we can figure out a way to recognize that,
versus having 20 years of experience in the field is something else.
That's true. Senator Stedman.
Yes, just on this, the issue of trying to fit in someone out of the TERS system, because I think that's more where the concern is than the PERS, but clearly in TERS there's educators that teach calculus, entry-level statistics in business, accounting, you know, in high school. And clearly, I assume that some of the other educators and lower grade levels may still have, you know, a lot of exposure to those areas. So I would think there'd be, with all the school systems in the state, I would think there'd be quite a few that would qualify. And, you know, one thing that might be kind of nice for someone that teaches, you know, beginning business or statistics or calculus, things like that, to be able to bring real-world examples right into their classroom. I don't know if they would do that, but they could certainly connect.
Let's see if we can find the language that satisfies.
Yeah, again, I think the current language is not too restrictive to allow that.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate HB 141's providing provisions for health reimbursement accounts. I really would like us to see go all the way to offering health savings accounts. And I've got a bill in that kind of requires the state to offer that option to all state employees. But I'd like for us to have a discussion on why can't we take the next step in this bill to provide for full-blown health savings accounts, as long as we're doing this huge change to...
Now, have you been discussing that with Melanie and Kevin or anyone?
Not directly. I've been trying to get this administration to consider health savings accounts for 2 years, and I've gotten no response.
That's not a good sign, Senator Dyson.
I'm sorry?
That's not a good sign.
Well, you know? And...
This doesn't mean it's bad. I'm not saying that.
But the feds have gotten a significant piece of legislation through. The regulations are being written. Mm-hmm. 7 or 8 other states are doing it. Extraordinary number of companies are doing it. And a very significant number of NGOs, non-government organizations, are really finding it a way to do it. And the insurance industry has rolled out some really very attractive products. And so if there's an opportunity for us to gain some ground on what I see as a huge part of the solution to containment of health costs, I'd really like us to make sure, see if we can do it with this vehicle, which I'm very appreciative of.
Okay, let me add one thing, and then maybe I can add anything on the current topic. That back up for a minute to Senator Bundy's issue. The recognized competence is defined, didn't make it in this draft, but I guess the language is currently there to come in. Defined as 10 years of professional experience. Just throw that out, you know, and I'm not saying we still shouldn't tweak it a little bit, but I guess that they did define that. Maybe let me switch gears a little bit to Senator Dyson's issue. Mm-hmm. And we may need some assistance from staff, but if I recall correctly, we looked at the health savings account issue versus the health reimbursement account. And some of the benefits of the health reimbursement account was it was all employer, it was tax deferred compounding and tax free coming out, and we felt that mechanism was more advantageous not only to the employee but the employer, and it just fit better in what we were doing, and that's why we selected that. It was an item of discussion when we got to that point, between which one of the two we should pick up. And possibly Tracy or Miles could get with Senator Dyson's office or Senator Dyson and elaborate a little bit more on that, and then we can kind of take it from there if he wants to go further. But it was in the decision-making process of this bill.
Senator Wilkin, I'm so sorry. We digressed.
Back to you. Go ahead. That's fine. I just had a few more questions in it, and they may lead to something that won't surprise you. I haven't read the whole bill. is there a penalty for early withdrawal of employee contributions contemplated in the bill?
For defined contribution?
They have an account that they're building,
And if they quit, what do they do with that money?
There's a vesting schedule. The employee's contributions always stay with the employee, so there is really no penalty on rollover.
Is it the employer side?
On the employer side, then there's the vesting schedule issue.
So if I'm an employee and I quit and I take my 10 years of contributions with me, then I can do what I want. If I roll them over, fine. If I use them to buy a car, then I just pay taxes per federal obligation.
Be my understanding correct that you could roll it to your IRA, roll it to your new employee, or excuse me, employer?
And the penalty. Okay. But that would fall under federal legislation.
IRS.
Under
IRS.
Okay. The 10% federal penalty.
Okay.
Next one.
Can a retired employee set, if I retire at 55 and I start to receive monies back, can I adjust my can I adjust my draw out of my account as I see fit, or is it a fixed amount?
We didn't get into that detail in the statute, but let me just answer that generally. It would be a variable distribution option. I don't think it would be. Of course, it's going to have to, you know, this is something that will get worked out later. But if you say you retired at, or you're out at 55, and you wanted to pull some money out at 60 or 58 or something like that, or you would, upon separation, you could roll that money into your IRA and do what you so choose. And if it's with the employer, they may have some other parameters on it, Generally, you would not lock into a distribution where there's no flexibility. I don't see so that there, as a
first through regulation or statute. There'll be the ability to regulate your draw from your account.
Right.
It's not fixed. It could be variable.
Right.
Okay.
The 59 and a half, the IRS.
Yeah. Right. You got a 50. You have a 59 and a half. Age requirement to meet to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Oh, okay.
It's like an IRA.
And then my last question, and I think, Senator, I think you may have talked about it. This draft that's probably one of the best ones in the whole presentation.
You want some more papers, that right? You want some more graphs?
They did a wonderful job on this, and this tells the whole story. What are we doing with the legislation in regard to employee increasing existing employee contribution? Your 50 basis points you spoke about earlier this week, mm-hmm. Is that going to be in the legislation?
It is. I already checked it. It's in there.
Okay.
There's the issue of, and I think the Attorney General's office is going to, you know, have some more data on that. It'll be out maybe hopefully this week, and clearly before we can get the bill through the whole system. And we're looking at the issue of increasing employee contributions into the normal service cost and the past service cost.
And does it set a policy that we're going to expect the employee and the employer to participate 50-50 or 60-40?
50 basis points. Currently in draft F, it's 50 basis points increase maximum per year up to a point where it's an equal shared cost between the employer and the employee on a normal service cost, not the unfunded liability. And it's real important for people to realize this, you know, those contributions do not go to the, in our bill, to the past service liability or the $5.7 billion underfunding.
And the legislation then would allow that to increase up or down depending on costs, and the split would continue to be 50-50?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That's my questions. Thanks.
Very, very good. We're going to go off the record for just a moment, please.